Jerry Strosheim. Actually, it's Gerald, but I am listed in this court's records as Jerry. The attorney for the appellant in this case. I believe that this case belongs in the state court. As I have set out at length in my brief, the United States Supreme Court has stated in plain language how you determine jurisdiction in a removal, a jurisdiction to remove in a civil case to the federal court. The Rivet case, R-I-V-E-T, is quoted at length in my brief. That is one reason why the lower courts had no jurisdiction to decide the Rivet case differently from the Supreme Court. In addition, the lower courts had no reason, no justification for deciding this case on the basis of bankruptcy jurisdiction in the bankruptcy court. And I have set out that at great length in my brief. I'm going to spend most of my time discussing a little bit more the jurisdiction, because I don't think the court should ever reach the merits of this case. First, Rivet said, decided by the Supreme Court, Rivet said that jurisdiction is governed by Rivet. And I believe the word governed is very significant. As the Supreme Court once said in a different context, when we say something, we mean something, and we say what we mean. And I think that's what the Rivet case says. It says governed. And I believe that that should be the end of the inquiry, because Rivet says...
Did Rivet have in touch in any respect on bankruptcy and the ability of a bankruptcy court to have jurisdiction in civil matters that arise under or related to a bankruptcy matter?
Rivet was a bankruptcy case to begin with. I mean, in the trial court, in the bankruptcy court in Rivet, the order entered was an order to sell property free and clear of liens. When it got to the Rivet, there was a split in circuits, and there was a question of state court suit, and then there was a split in the circuits as to whether the defense that the federal courts had entered an order, that is the bankruptcy court, had entered an order, whether that could be the basis for jurisdiction of removal. And Rivet said absolutely not. It said it in two ways. It not only said governed, but it said you need to have something other than a defense. You have to put the federal claim, a federal claim, and I take it a bankruptcy case is a federal claim, no matter what opposing counsel say, but you have to have a federal claim stated in the complaint under the well-pled complaint rule. And so I think that Rivet should really dispose of this case.
Mr. Strosheim, what were the mechanics of removal of this from the court in Ainsworth, Nebraska, to the federal court? How did that happen?
Well,
you filed your suit in state court, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and then how did it, what were the mechanics?
We filed a complaint in state court. The appellants in this case were the plaintiffs and the defendants were the appellees. I think about a week after we filed the complaint, removal papers purporting to remove the case to the Nebraska Bankruptcy Court were filed by the defendants. The case actually then laid for a while because, well, let me back up and say, originally, the bankruptcy judge entered an opinion, sua sponte, without notice to parties, that said this case belongs in state court. He remanded it to state court, but then it went to the district court, and the district court entered an order saying, you didn't give notice.
The federal district court, you're talking
about? The federal district court. The federal district court said, you can't enter an order remanding the case without notice to the parties. And I don't question that ruling. But the case was there in district court for about a year. And then it went back to the bankruptcy court. The district court also said in its opinion, and that's the only issue decided by the district court, but it said in its opinion that there may be merit to the opinion that it does not belong in the state court. And then the bankruptcy judge, I think, decided that was a message from a higher judicial authority to reconsider its first ruling. Okay. In any event, we had a motion, a denial of the motion, and it went back.
Okay. What about jurisdiction under the related to provision in the bankruptcy statute?
Well, I think that you have to have a conceivable effect on the bankruptcy estate of somebody. And
isn't what you're asking for something that could conceivably affect the estate of this AFY company?
Well, I think that it cannot conceivably affect that. The prayer in the state court is a suit against defendants. It is not claiming any share of the estate. It is not claiming against anyone but the defendants in that suit. And so I don't think that it can affect that estate. Now, maybe somebody, I don't think also, I might say, that the individual estates of Robert and Corley Sears are subject to any effect when you're just collecting from somebody. I don't believe that should constitute an effect of the estate. I would like to briefly comment on the 1334, the bankruptcy jurisdiction problem. The bankruptcy court, and as I've set out in my brief, does not have arising jurisdiction. The bankruptcy court is a district court, not the bankruptcy court. It does not have arising jurisdiction. But that has the consequence that not only is there no jurisdiction, but the bankruptcy court can't go off on its own and enter a final order, ignoring the statute, ignoring the Constitution as interpreted by the United States Supreme Court. And I believe there's a double-barreled lack of jurisdiction in the bankruptcy court to decide the case on the basis that I've said. I would simply say that on the merits, I have set out at length in my brief the reasons why the bankruptcy judge is in error. The error was the bankruptcy judge held that its prior order was res judicata, a res judicata bar against a suit in the state court. The res judicata argument was predicated on the fact that it had entered a prior order. It could not have been res judicata as a matter of law, because in the Lane v. Peterson case in this circuit, the court has held, following the restatement of judgments, that you cannot have the same claim for purposes of jurisdiction if it's a liability against two different parties. That has to be governed by the rules of collateral estoppel or issue preclusion. And issue preclusion is not res judicata. I would, at this time, unless the court has more questions, and I want to repeat, this court should never reach the merits of this appeal, in my opinion. I would at this time then save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Ms. Grossheim. Ms. Krueger?
Your Honors, may it please the Court, my name is Kristen Krieger, and I represent the Sears family defendants in this case, the appellees. Your Honors, this most recent lawsuit is the most recent litigation arising out of and related to the AFY bankruptcy, which was filed in 2010. It has now lasted 10 years and has included countless appeals to the U.S. District Court, the Bankruptcy Appellate Panel, this court, and there was also a petition for writ of certiorari to the Supreme Court at one point in time. These particular parties, I believe, have been before the Eighth Circuit four different times on appeals related to the AFY bankruptcy and the bankruptcy of the individual plaintiff, Corley Sears. So Robert Sears' and Corley Sears' latest effort is this particular lawsuit, which they filed in Nebraska State Court. It was timely removed to the bankruptcy court by the Sears family defendants, and that's because the complaint presents a straightforward collateral attack on multiple final orders that were entered by the bankruptcy court in the AFY bankruptcy, and which have all been affirmed on appeal. As the bankruptcy court recognized, if the plaintiffs were to be successful in this lawsuit, it would render everything done in the AFY bankruptcy meaningless. As both the bankruptcy court and the bankruptcy appellate panel found, the claims are subject to dismissal for two independent reasons. The first is that Robert and Corley's claims are barred by the shareholder standing rule, and the second is that they're barred by preclusion. These claims have all been litigated before, and they're barred from being litigated again.
They were shareholders of the corporations that fought it out below. Is that the idea?
That's correct. Robert and Corley have represented that they're the sole shareholders of AFY since all of this began in 2010. A significant amount of the briefing in this case has related to the jurisdiction and authority of the bankruptcy court. Most of those arguments were not raised before the bankruptcy court to the extent that any of them were. But as the bankruptcy appellate panel recognized, the bankruptcy court had jurisdiction to enter a final order dismissing the complaint. And the bankruptcy court and the bankruptcy appellate panel affirmed that decision in all respects. First, because I know that Mr. Strassheim raised questions regarding jurisdiction, I'll address those first here with respect to bankruptcy court jurisdiction. So the Sears family defendants removed this case to bankruptcy court under 1334B. The Sears family defendants did that because this is a case that is arising in, or at the very least related to, the bankruptcies of AFY, Corley Sears, and Robert Sears. Corley Sears and Robert Sears are both still individual Chapter 11 debtors. But first and foremost, it was because this is an arising in proceeding. That is what the bankruptcy court ultimately found that it had, and the BAP agreed with that conclusion as well. And that's because when you look at, you know, the question under arising in jurisdiction, it's whether these claims somehow, could they somehow exist without the AFY bankruptcy? And they simply cannot. These claims don't exist without the AFY bankruptcy, and by that I mean the claims that are set forth in the complaint that was filed in state court, and they don't exist outside the AFY bankruptcy. The complaint alleges that the Sears family defendants engaged in wrongful conduct in the AFY bankruptcy, and that wrongful conduct resulted in final bankruptcy orders that they are essentially and effectively seeking to undo. The complaint's a collateral attack, we believe, on four specific orders that were entered in the AFY bankruptcy. That would be the allowance of the defendant's AFY proofs of claim, the appointment of the Chapter 11 trustee, the conversion to Chapter 7, and the distribution of AFY bankruptcy estate proceeds. Essentially, arising in jurisdiction exists here because the case law is clear that it exists to interpret or enforce a bankruptcy court order, even when the claim presented is a quote-unquote state law claim or quote-unquote state law theory of recovery, when essentially what you're asking a court to do is interpret or enforce a bankruptcy court order that is itself a court proceeding. So if you're asking a court to interpret or enforce a bankruptcy court order that's been entered in a court proceeding, that itself results in there being a court proceeding. That is what both the bankruptcy court and the BAP concluded. With respect to, I know, Judge, you had asked a question about related to jurisdiction. Certainly, I think at a minimum, there's no question that related to jurisdiction exists here. And as Mr. Strassheim noted, the test for related to jurisdiction is the conceivable effects test, meaning do the claims in this complaint have some sort of conceivable effect on the AFY bankruptcy estate? The plaintiffs argue that they don't because the AFY bankruptcy estate's been closed and they're really just seeking direct monetary damages from the defendants. But that's not really what the complaint's asking for. What the complaint's asking is that a court find that the defendants should not have been paid these multi-million dollar distributions from the AFY bankruptcy estate, and that they should have to disgorge those, and that they never should have been paid those monies to begin with. Well, if that's what a court finds, then the result isn't that the plaintiffs become entitled to that money. The result would theoretically be that the defendants would somehow have to pay that money back to the AFY bankruptcy estate. And so they don't get to somehow bypass the AFY bankruptcy estate pursuant to these claims. It would also have to go back through the AFY bankruptcy because what they're assuming is that they would have been entitled to the money, not some other creditor in the AFY bankruptcy. But I don't think you can do that without having to reopen the bankruptcy estate under Section 350B of the Bankruptcy Code. But moreover, certainly with respect to the related to jurisdiction, the case was removed with respect to and in relation to the AFY bankruptcy and Robert and Corley's bankruptcy. Certainly, when Robert and Corley are asking for damages of millions and millions of dollars, that money, because they are Chapter 11 debtors, would come into their bankruptcy estates. And so it, of course, would have a conceivable effect on their bankruptcy estates. That money would then exist for their creditors. So the idea that this somehow isn't related to Robert and Corley as Chapter 11 individual debtors, as plaintiffs in this lawsuit, doesn't hold weight. And I know Mr. Strassheim has discussed quite a bit here on the Rivet case, and the plaintiffs rely on Rivet to argue there is no jurisdiction. Defendant's understanding is that the Rivet Supreme Court case, it's based on Section 1331. So it's a 1331 case. It's not a 1334 case. And in Rivet, what the Supreme Court said was that if a lawsuit gets filed in state court and you as a defendant argue and bring up the defense right away, this is barred by claim preclusion based on a federal court judgment. That argument in and of itself, that claim preclusion argument, doesn't give rise to an independent federal question under 1331. So that can't be, you can't rely on 1331 in that circumstance as your basis for removal to federal court. But here, the Sears family defendants didn't rely on 1331 to remove the case to federal court. They strictly relied on 1334B, both arising in and related to. So in that regard, Rivet doesn't have any applicability to this matter. The one final note I'll make here with respect to this matter is Both the bankruptcy court and the bankruptcy appellate panel found that the claims are barred by the shareholder standing rule. And that holding and that conclusion gives this court an opportunity in and of itself to completely dispose of this case without having to get into any other issues or arguments that may have been made. As this court's previously held in a 2013 AFY appeal, the court can decide jurisdictional questions in any order. Standing presents a jurisdictional question. With no standing, there is no jurisdiction. And so the shareholder standing rule provides a complete basis to affirm both of the courts below. The shareholder standing rule provides that if a harm's been directed toward a corporation, so in this case the allegation is AFY, then only AFY itself has standing to assert claims. In this instance, for Robert and Corley, as shareholders of AFY, to somehow have standing, they must allege in the complaint that they have suffered direct, non-derivative injuries in their individual capacities. They have not done so. All of the allegations in the complaint are allegations of harm that's been inflicted on AFY or somehow the AFY bankruptcy estate. So it goes back to the entire premise of the lawsuit, as the bankruptcy court explained, is this idea that the bankruptcy court got it wrong when it allowed the Sears defendant's proofs of claim and found AFY liable under the stock sale agreement that gives rise to all of this. And so when it's from that incorrect legal argument that's set forth in the complaint that all of the other allegations flow. There is no allegation in the complaint of any direct or non-derivative injury to Robert or Corley. I know that they argued in their brief that because they themselves are parties to the stock sale agreement, they're somehow able to get around the shareholder standing rule. But that's only if you assume that there's somehow some obligation owed to Robert or Corley that's left under the stock sale agreement. And that's not what's alleged in the complaint, and that's because it simply doesn't exist. Robert and Corley were parties to this stock sale agreement insofar as they were owed things that were already provided to them years ago. Corley was a buyer. He got stock in exchange for promising to pay the defendants money. The defendants have given him that stock. They're now just owed money from him, and that's why they filed proofs of claim in Corley's bankruptcy. But he's not owed anything further. Similarly, the same thing is true of Robert. Robert's a party because he pledged collateral to secure Corley's obligation to pay. But with respect to both of those, Your Honors, they're not owed anything under the stock sale agreement, and they don't allege that they're still owed anything under the stock sale agreement in the complaint. The claims are barred by the shareholder standing rule because each and every one of them, whether it's the breach of contract claim, a tortious interference claim, unjust enrichment, civil conspiracy, all of those are barred by the shareholder standing rule. And so the shareholder standing rule in and of itself provides this court with a singular basis to dispose of this appeal, affirm both of the courts below, and have the AFY litigation finally, hopefully, come to an end. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I can sit down.
I see none. Thank you, Ms. Krieger.
Thank you.
Mr. Strassheim, your rebuttal.
Thank you. The Eighth Circuit did hold, in a case the name of which I forget, that when you have two objections to jurisdictions, you can choose your jurisdiction. But the Supreme Court held in the People's or the Steel Company case, it was actually Judge Scalia, but in the Steel Company case, they rejected the so-called hypothetical jurisdiction rule, where courts were saying it's easier to decide the case on the merits and just assume there's jurisdiction. They said you can't do that. That's illogical. That's not sense. And also, that rule in the Eighth Circuit would depend upon only whether there is clearly jurisdiction. Now, as far as the contracts, we are suing on promises made to us, not promises made to AFY. under Section 10 of the restatement, if the contract involving several people says it does not say differently, then it's a promise is made to everybody, and we put that in our complaint. I think it's paragraph 45. And in section 288 of the restatement, there's also a presumption that if you don't use words of severance, you've made promises to everyone. We are not suing on the promises made to AFY. If those promises may result in a collateral estoppel argument, if we actually litigated, or if we did certain other things, but it is not the same claim. It is the same contract. Now, I want to say one other thing. The arising in argument ignores the precedent of the Eighth Circuit in what I call, well, it's GAF, G-A-F, the Rinaldi, what I call the farm credit case. There was a suit in which the parties claimed, just as it's being claimed in this case, that there was arising in jurisdiction. Arising jurisdiction should be rejected because this court, in the GAF case, has held otherwise. And the only authority cited by the appellees is the Williams case, decided by BAP 10 years earlier than the GAF case. I think that the related to argument is something that I think has got to be understood what we said in our complaint. There is no law cited that says if we recover from the defendants, the money has to go back to the estate of AFY. There is no law cited that says that we have got to only ask in our complaint for relief, which we did not, that the money goes back to AFY. We're saying we want the money from defendants, and that's what the complaint says. Now, if there are no further questions, my time's up. So, is there any further questions?
I see none.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Strassheim. Thank you also, Ms. Krieger. We appreciate both parties' argument to the court this morning, the briefing which you have provided to us. We will take the case under advisement.